May it please the Court. The risk of error created by Missouri's termination statute is unconstitutional because it allows trial courts to destroy family relationships based on the same degree of confidence that the trial court has in an ordinary civil case awarding monetary damages. The issue before this court is whether a trial court conducting a single hearing can properly and constitutionally apply two different standards of proof to three factual findings, all within that one hearing.
It's important. Now, in this case, the judge specifically says on the best interest of the child that he's providing, using the preponderance of evidence, not the clear and convincing standard.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's the standard the trial court applied. That's the standard that the lower courts have mandated. In fact, the lower courts in this state have required that preponderance of the evidence be the standard applied to the best interest factors, and that it's a reversible error to require a higher standard, despite the fact that Santosky v. Kramer, a United States Supreme Court case, requires that factors supporting a termination of parental rights case be supported by at least clear and convincing evidence.
But isn't, under the Missouri statute, isn't the dispositional stage where you consider best interests, and that it's if you find the factors for termination, you apply a clear and convincing evidence standard at that first level, and you have to find the factors permitting, one of the grounds for termination is shown. When you've done that, then you turn to the best interests standard, and Santosky is clear that in the dispositional stage, you don't have to use a clear and convincing evidence. You can use a preponderance of the evidence test. Why isn't that best interest analysis under the dispositional stage deciding is it in the best interest of the child to go back with the parent despite the fact that there's grounds, or to go with a foster parent or someone else, some other situation? Or is it in their best interest to terminate?
Your Honor, the critical distinction between Santosky and the Missouri statute, and the one that in fact makes the Missouri statute in some ways worse than the New York statute, is that the New York statute provided for bifurcated hearings, not just a bifurcated decision-making process. In other words, there was one hearing at which evidence was presented on the grounds for termination itself. That was separate and apart from any consideration of best interests. In this case, the trial court considered not only the grounds for termination under 211.447, but also the factors supporting those grounds and the best interest factors, and made those factual findings all in the same hearing. The fact that there is a risk of error inherent in having just one proceeding in which there are two different standards of proof applied places this case firmly within the realm of Santosky and requires the same outcome.
But there's a difference between the initial stage and the secondary stage in that the termination of parental rights is an irrevocable, critical proceeding in which due process requires that higher standard of proof, the clear, cogent, convincing evidence. When you get to the dispositional stage of best interest, a parent and the child could be adverse parties. So a lesser standard of proof, preponderance of the evidence, seems to be endorsed by Santosky and what we do in Missouri.
Your Honor, first I would suggest that Santosky never reached the question of whether or not that second, the dispositional hearing, was in fact appropriately governed by a lower standard.
If the that's court, true, isn't the language on that case that you're relying on then just dicta?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe it is, because Santosky focused on the risk of error. And in evaluating that risk of error, applying the Matthews v. Eldridge factors that the Supreme Court also set out, it focused on that second Matthews versus Eldridge factor, which was the risk of error. And it found that under New York's particular scheme, because there were separate hearings, that a lesser standard may be appropriate. But here we don't have that benefit. We don't have a separate hearing to evaluate whether or not.
So in effect, what you're really complaining about is our holding of a single hearing as opposed to the fact that there's a preponderance of the evidence standard at the dispositional stage.
Your Honor, my suggestion is that it's sort of an either-or. Separate hearings may be the appropriate way to balance that risk, or imposition of a higher standard. I think the imposition of a higher standard is more well-founded in the language of the statute itself. The language of the statute never requires that a preponderance of the evidence be applied to the best interest factors. The statute is silent as to that. The only standard that is listed in Section 211.447 is the clear, cogent, and convincing evidence standard. So the lower...
Isn't it logical to apply a preponderance standard at the dispositional stage in light of the U.S. Supreme Court statement in Santosky that after the state has established parental unfitness at the initial proceeding. The court may assume at the dispositional stage that the interests of the child and the natural parents do diverge. And if their interests diverge, then why would you make a higher burden on one than the other? If they're conflicting interests, the court needs to look fairly at all the evidence and decide what the best interests of the child are. Why would they give a have a higher standard at that point when they've already found that one of the parties is grounds for termination of the rights one of the parties exists, and that party's interests may conflict with the child's?
The first part of the answer, Your Honor, is the importance of the burden of proof itself. In Santosky and in Addington, the Supreme Court has said the function of a burden of proof is to impress upon the fact finder the degree of confidence which he or she must have in the evidence and the outcome. When there's a finding that's so critical, as Missouri courts have held it is, such as best interests, and the fact finder is told both by statute and case law that is the most critical finding in one of these hearings, but then is told your degree of confidence in the evidence supporting that finding must only be supported by a preponderance of the evidence. Your findings as to the other factors, which are less critical under Missouri's scheme, must be supported by higher evidence. There's a disconnect there, and that goes back to the degree of risk, which is the key issue in Santosky and in the application of the Matthews v. Eldridge factors. There's simply put no justification for requiring a lesser standard, even if the parent and the child's interests do diverge. I would point out that Missouri Statute Section 211.443 sets forth three factors that courts are to consider in construing Missouri's termination statutes. The first of those is the recognition and protection of the constitutional rights of all parties in the proceedings. The second is the recognition and protection of the birth family relationship. So it's not just the parent's interest, it's the recognition of the birth family relationship as a whole. So the child also has an interest in maintenance of that relationship. So even if the parents and the child's relationship or interests do diverge after a theoretical fact-finding hearing that's separate from a dispositional finding, which I submit is not what we actually had in this case, then there is still an interest that must be balanced. And the risk of error in determining whether or not that interest is protected should not be the same as the court applies in a car accident when it's trying to determine who is at fault and who is entitled to personal injury damages.
Mr. Murray, isn't the trial court fully capable of utilizing those different standards of proof and utilizing the clear, cogent, convincing on the one hand and preponderance of the evidence on the other?
I believe the trial courts are capable, Your Honor. What I would point out is that language in Santosky and in its progeny have focused on the risk of error in the trial court considering these necessarily subjective factors, and particularly when you have three separate factual findings that must be made, a grounds for termination, a factor supporting that ground, and then a best interest determination, which must be supported by seven particular factors, then you have a heightened risk of error, regardless of whether or not the trial court is able to appropriately evaluate each individual factor, apply the specific standards to those particular pieces of evidence, and come to a conclusion. Moreover, I would point out that in this case, as is referenced in both points 2 and 3, we have a judgment which doesn't, in the majority of its findings, reflect which standard of proof it actually applied. In fact, only one finding made by the trial court as to a grounds for termination in paragraph 14 of the judgment was supported by clear, cogent, and convincing evidence.
But isn't that enough?
One finding would be enough, Your Honor. However, there are factors under that particular ground.
Well, the problem is that those seven factors do not apply in all termination cases because they certainly don't apply in the private adoption cases. So in the private adoption cases, which has the two-step process, aren't courts used to applying clear and convincing evidence standard to one, and then they have the separate hearing, the separate phase where then they go through the best evidence test? So, I mean, I don't see why our trial courts aren't used to distinguishing between the two different processes.
And I'm not suggesting they're not used to it, Your Honor. What I'm suggesting is that the risk of error that is inherent in having a single hearing at which three factual findings are made pursuant to two different standards is unacceptable under Santosky and under the 14th Amendment to the Constitution.
Well, I disagree that, I mean, our legislature has specifically delineated the different factors that have to be examined by the trial court in making these very important decisions, as opposed to a not specifically laying them out and letting the trial court be more subjective about it. It seems to me that there's a lot of things that they have to consider specifically before they can make a subjective decision.
There are, Your Honor. And one thing I would point out is there are not just the seven best interest factors set forth in 211.447, I believe subsection 7, but there are also the factors which are necessary to support a grounds for termination. Particularly in this case, the trial court found by clear, cogent, and convincing evidence that 211.447, subsection 2, was proven by clear, cogent, and convincing evidence. Under that subsection, the trial court must make findings as to four factual factors. And in this case, we don't know what standard the trial court applied to those factors. It's not set forth in his judgment. It's not part of that clear, cogent, and convincing paragraph that supports the grounds. So my point is that although we have a finding as to a grounds, we don't know what his factual findings were. We don't know what degree of proof he applied to make those findings. And those are findings which are necessary in order to terminate parental rights.
Does the statute require a particular standard for those all those findings?
It's not called out in the statute itself, Your Honor. I believe it's clearly set forth in Santosky. Those are factual findings made at the fact-finding stage, which are necessary. At least one of those must be proven in order to sustain a termination of parental rights.
The problem with that is, aren't there? There's court of appeals cases that say under the termination proceedings under I think it's 452, that those findings do not have to be made. So if those specific findings do not have to be made, those also involve termination of parental rights cases, and our trial judges are, you know, sometimes they're presented with under the juvenile code, sometimes they're presented with a private adoption. The legislature may have different reasons for different requirements, but there is no requirement in those cases for these specific findings. So would you have us as a court then import what the legislature hasn't done as to what types of findings a judge would have to make and have little line on this one I did clear and convincing and because the scales were instantly tilted and this one I did preponderance because I just thought it was more likely. I mean, is that the type of detail you think is really required by the Constitution?
Your Honor, I see that my time has expired. May I answer? First, I would point out that as far as the adoption action goes, there are a different set of private interests at stake. There's a different balancing act that's not necessarily taking place when you have termination of parental rights brought by the state. Setting that aside, however, if you look at Section 211.447, particularly subsections 2 and 3, which were at issue in this case, the statutory language is clear that the trial court shall consider and make findings on those factors. The courts of appeal have interpreted that to mean that at least one of those findings, one of those factors, must be proven. The standard as to any of them must be clear, at least clear and convincing evidence under the rule set forth in Santosky, because they are factual findings necessary to support termination. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, BH was a five-year-old child at the time that this hearing came up, and our contention from the juvenile officer standpoint is that the trial court did not err in terminating the mother's parental rights, and her due process rights were not violated. Well, the mother has relied on Santosky versus Kramer, saying that it requires the standard of proof utilized be clear, cogent, and convincing. But that's misplaced because the New York statute was different from that of Missouri's. Missouri's statute is distinguished in that it requires the two-step process. And this was spelled out by the Missouri court in Re LM, a 2007 case.
How does this two-step process work when it's not a bifurcated proceeding? Does both evidence come in?
The evidence is heard at once, all at once, but you have to make that finding first that there are grounds. Once you've established that there are grounds, then you can move to the best interest. And we've seen that also in Re KCM, where the court said if the first step is satisfied and the ground is established by clear, cogent, and convincing evidence, then the trial court moves to the second step and determines whether termination is in the best interest of the child.
So even though it's not bifurcated, the judge bifurcates the decision-making in the case?
Yes, the judge can make that determination himself. Judges make those determinations all the time in all types of cases.
Just the evidence is compartmentalized, just like separate causes of action. If a case was tried together where there were different causes of action, it may be that some evidence supports both findings.
That is
but
correct.
But judges are required to compartmentalize evidence every day they go to work.
And sometimes the evidence is interrelated because you're looking at what's happened over a period of time normally, and there's a lot of different facts that come into play.
And your opponent is arguing that because we don't have a bifurcated proceeding and because there's two different standards of proof allegedly required in making this decision, that there's a constitutional violation.
We see no constitutional violation there. We believe that the court is extremely competent and can parse out that evidence and apply the different standards to it. The Santosky case was also based on Matthews v. Eldridge, which required a balancing test. And they were looking at the private interests affected by the proceeding, the risk of error created by the state's chosen procedure, and the countervailing governmental interest supporting the use of the challenge procedure. And Missouri's system, as it is, does just that. It's balancing all those interests. Once those grounds are proven, then the burden shifts, and we look at the best interest of the child. After those grounds have been met, the interests of the parent and the child diverge, and we look and focus on what is in the best interest of this child. Section 211.443 provides that termination statutes shall be construed to include consideration of the entitlement of every child to a permanent and stable home. And we feel that the current case does just that, and protects the child as well as the parent. The second case that appellant relied on to support his argument was Cannon v. Cannon. And we did not interpret that case the same way because the exact language stated, the Supreme Court has held that because of the final and irrevocable nature of rights termination, the state must present clear, cogent, and convincing evidence that termination is in the child's best interest. But when you actually look at Cannon, you see that this was a divorce case, which was talking about a husband's visitation rights with his child after a conviction on a sexual offense. And the language that the court was using in Cannon was in the course of a comparison of the different standards of proof applicable to other types of cases, such as paternity cases.
And so your argument is that's just a misstatement in Cannon of what the rule of law was.
That's correct, Your Honor.
As the author of Cannon, it cites to Santosky, which is talking about the termination grounds, not the best interest grounds. And it seems
that's
to be
correct.
Broad language.
It's a whole different kind of body of law, I think. And another consideration supporting our interpretation is the history of the cases in Missouri. We have in the interest of AS, the Southern District case from 2001 that tells us once the finding that termination is in the best interest, it does not require proof by clear, cogent, and convincing evidence. And it relied on earlier cases which were in the interest of JNC, a 1996 case, and in the interest of JDB, a 1991 case. The last reason we think that appellant's argument fails is that in order to invalidate a statute, which is the ultimate outcome that appellant is asking this court to take, that statute has to clearly and undoubtedly contravene the Constitution and plainly and palpably affront fundamental law embodied in the Constitution. And we see that in Lewis versus Gibbons. And that simply hasn't happened here. The child's history and condition demonstrate that he was subject to significant abuse and neglect by the appellant. And this appellant was afforded a full evidentiary hearing, and she had counsel. Her constitutional rights were protected by the court and by the provisions of Section 211.447. The second point for appellant claims that the court did not make clear, cogent, and convincing findings. But we would argue that they did under 211.447.52. And that was found in paragraph 14. And it only takes one ground in order to be able to terminate parental rights. We can see that the court did not say clear, cogent, and convincing with respect to jurisdiction over a year and potentially harmful conditions and unfitness. But we believe that that one ground of abuse and neglect was fully supported by the evidence. They had found that the mother had a permanent mental condition, that her mental retardation prevents her from even comprehending the child's problems.
But, counsel, your opponent's argument is that although the ground was specifically found by clear, cogent, convincing evidence, all of this, all these little factors underneath, as you're discussing right now, did not articulate those magical words again. And is that fatal?
We do not believe that is fatal, Your Honor. We believe that the paragraph 14 relates back and talks about clear, cogent, convincing. We believe that the rest of it relates back to paragraph 14, and there was
the subpart
more than
paragraph 17.
Correct, Your Honor.
They don't need to be specifically found by clear, cogent, convincing evidence.
We don't believe so, Your Honor. We believe that paragraph 14 covered that under the abuse ground, and the fact that the court found that the mother also had repeatedly failed to provide care and control necessary for the child's emotional health and development. The developmental causes were caused by neglect, and the behavior and emotional problems were trauma-related. The child's anxiety and aversion to visits were attributed to abuse while in the mother's care. And so we believe that the court made sufficient findings to support the abuse and neglect ground. The third point by appellant we did not feel was compelling, as he talked about lack of statement of future harm by the mother, and he relied on in the interest of KAW. The KAW case was a completely different set of facts, and that was a mother who was trying to find a home for her twins. The KAW mother was not neglectful or abusive, contrasting to this mother who had a long history of abuse. And her rights had been terminated to seven other children. She'd been offered services for a number of years. She was a sexual offender. And this child had huge emotional and behavioral problems brought on as a result of his abuse. Your Honor, we would ask that the court affirm the judgment and find that the mother's due process rights were not violated. This child needs permanency.
Now, counsel, your opponent cites in his brief that there's some statements made in CW as well as KAW that are contrary to what you're arguing. Is there any distinction you can make of those cases, or how do you answer that argument?
Your Honor, I would just say that KAW, if you look at the facts, those are nowhere similar to this. We need to look at present conditions, and you can determine present conditions based on past conditions. And we believe that the court made a finding of that in which, when the court said there is no reasonable likelihood that the condition can be reversed and it renders the mother unable to knowingly provide.
If I recall CW, wasn't that the case that the mother had bipolar?
On our mother?
CW, in the CW case, wasn't that?
I don't recall, Your Honor.
Because I think that was the case where they were using a test that was done 3 years before, and then she sought treatment. So the condition could be changed if she had treatment. That's not the situation in this case.
In this case, no, Your Honor. Lots of services were implemented. And in any case, any time you are looking at a parent, you're looking at past conduct. What they're proposing is you would have to have up-to-the-date, that day, evidence to look at what the future is. You can't always predict the future, but by looking at the past and the past history of this mother, you see that she is never going to be able to parent this child. Sadly, her limitations are too big, and she just can't do it, especially when you consider the behavioral and the traumatic injury that this child's had.
Where in the judgment does the trial court say that the past conduct explicitly points to the risk of future harm?
Your Honor, I believe they made a finding in 16A, number 6, where, or I'm sorry, 17A, number 6, it says the court finds that the mental health condition of the mother is of a permanent nature or such that there is no reasonable likelihood the condition can be reversed and renders the mother unable to knowingly provide the child the necessary care, custody, and control. I believe that covers it.
Does Skinner versus Oklahoma apply in this case?
I'm not sure, Your Honor.
Oliver Wendell Holmes.
No.
Thank you.
Thank you.
First, Your Honors, as to the ability of a trial court judge to separate the evidence and apply two different standards during one hearing, there's a portion of Santosky, I believe, that directly considers and not rejects that argument, but explains why it's a risk of error. At such a proceeding, numerous factors combine to magnify the risk of erroneous fact-finding, and it states that the judge in these cases has unusual discretion to underway probative facts that might favor the parent. Such proceedings are often vulnerable to judgment based on cultural or class bias. So although trial court judges do have that ability to separate the evidence, there is still a risk of error. There's always a risk of error in a trial court's judgment. What we should be doing in a termination of parental rights case, a decision that potentially destroys a family, that involves fundamental liberty interests, is minimizing that risk of error as much as possible. And the only way to do that in this case is by mandating a clear, cogent, and convincing evidence to all of the factual findings, which is what we're talking about here. This case has not even reached the dispositional phase. The adjudication is what we're talking about here. This was the adjudication hearing determining whether or not the parent was unfit and whether it was in the child's best interest.
Now, the measuring of preponderance, the evidence, clear, cogent, convincing, and beyond reasonable doubt, how does that fall in the between, beyond reasonable doubt and preponderance?
In terms of how does the court determine...
How does the judge measure what's the difference between them?
Well, the standard for clear, cogent, and convincing evidence is evidence that instantly tilts the scales and leaves the judge with an abiding conviction that the evidence is true. Contrast that with a preponderance of the evidence, which is just slightly more likely than not. That's a significant difference. In a trial court who's focusing on subjective factors...
If the judge is going to find for a preponderance of the evidence in a bench trial, is that something that convinces the judge that it's true? Doesn't the same standard... You say... When your further definition of clear, cogent, convincing, isn't that when the judge has to be convinced that it's true if they're going to find a preponderance of the evidence?
No, Your Honor, not necessarily. The trial court judge is evaluating that burden of proof because, again, the purpose of a burden of proof is to impress upon the fact finder what degree of confidence he or she must have in the outcome.
Doesn't it tip the scales, though? You say tipping the scales. If it's preponderance of the evidence, it's 51%. It seems to tip the scales one way or the other, whichever way the judge decides.
But that's certainly a distinct difference from instantly tilting the scales and leaving the judge with a firm conviction that the evidence is true. That's a significant difference in standards. And if it's not, then I would submit that there's no reason not to apply that higher standard.
But the clear and convincing evidence test is the overall burden of proof. It doesn't say that every fact, you have to be convinced of every sub-fact, of every piece of evidence. It has to be shown by clear and convincing evidence. You overall have to decide termination has been shown by clear and convincing evidence. It doesn't say you have to does it, that you have to find there's a mental condition by clear and convincing evidence and so forth. These are all facts you look at in the record and decide which ones are relevant and which ones aren't, and you look at them and weigh them and add them up, and they'll either instantly tilt the scales or they won't.
Your Honor, I see that my time has expired. May I answer?
Please.
I would submit first that the statute does require that each of those factors be weighed and that at least one of them be found. That's what the case law says. That's what the statute says. So the question of what standard of proof applies to each of those factors is a standard as to the collective nature of those factors, the decision overall. Again, it must be evidence that leaves that judge firmly convinced that the decision is true.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.